Arizona, your mountains, deserts, and streams, the rise of Dos Cabezas, and the outlaws I see in my dreams.
This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from the June 2025 issue of Arizona Highways. Richard Parker writes about JoJo Bob's. In May 2024, Joe Roger opened JoJo Bob's in Flagstaff's Fort Valley Shopping Center with the goal of sharing his chef-inspired, finely crafted sandwiches and deli staples with the neighborhood. But he was no stranger to the restaurant industry. Roger had worked with Michelin-starred chefs, traveled to Spain to expand his culinary skills, and earned additional experience with ventures in Tucson, Colorado, and Kansas City. His next stop was the former Subway location that JoJo Bob's now occupies. "I've helped open plenty of restaurants, but this is the first sandwich shop that I've owned," he says. "My background isn't in sandwiches at all, but when people find out that I have studied in certain Michelin kitchens, it starts to make a little bit of sense." And that's because his menu skews more elegant than your typical sandwich shop. Take, for example, the CBC sandwich. It features corned beef, cheek, Swiss cheese, sauerkraut, kimchi, and a spicy sauce. Other favorites include the risotto melt, oozing with mushrooms, smoked provolone, white beans, and arugula, and the MacArthur, stacked with turkey, provolone, avocado relish, lettuce, crushed chips, and mayonnaise. "We use noble bread," Roger says. "Thursdays, we sell our own sourdough loaves, and I try to get the best deli turkey I can find because I know what I want out of a sandwich." Roger is in the process of applying for a liquor license so he can host pop-ups, guest chef dinners, and other culinary get-togethers at the store. He also involves his partner, who bakes all of the deli's cookies and greets JoJo Bob's guests. But what about the name? Well, Roger's full name is Joseph Robert Roger, and after growing up with two nicknames, JoJo and Joe Bob, he decided to merge them when he named the deli. It's that creative mindset that also inspires the sandwiches, salads, and sides, which Roger updates regularly to keep the deli menus fresh. "I think failure is your best friend when you're trying to learn," he says. But the restaurant's reviews indicate that there's very little failure at JoJo Bob's. "Chef Joe doesn't take a day off," one reviewer quote. "We visited his amazing restaurant 3 times while we were staying in Flagstaff. He knocked it out of the park every time. JoJo Bob's is a must when you're in Flagstaff." JoJo Bob's is located at 1000 North Humphrey Street, Suite 128 in Flagstaff. Phone number 928-440-3522. Website jojobobs.com. Kathy Montgomery is the author of Puerco Pueblo Solstice Marker. For 2 weeks surrounding the summer solstice, a shaft of light will penetrate the center of a small spiral in a petroglyph at Petrified Forest National Park. Like other prehistoric cultures around the world, ancient Pueblans in the Southwest used solar calendars to mark the changing of the season. On the day before the winter solstice, I followed John Hardy's up a screen-covered trail at Petrified Forest National Park. "I've come to see a petroglyph known to interact with the sun this time of year, and I'm hoping to arrive at just the right time." "This petroglyph is really unique," says Hardy's, the park's lead archaeologist. "It's also in a pretty incredible setting. At what looks like a jumble of boulders, we locate a discreet entrance to a shelter created by enormous rock slabs. We don't have the right geology to have a lot of true caves," Hardy says, "but sometimes you'll get these really advantageous boulder arrangements. Inside, the space soars above our heads, and we crane our necks to examine a large spiral surrounded by a pair of feet in each of the cardinal directions. That thing amazes me," Hardy says. "It looks like it was made yesterday." Then we notice a wedge of sunlight brushing one of the feet. Not quite believing my eyes, I ask, "Is this it?" In a few minutes, the light has disappeared. We compare the image I've captured on my phone to a published photo made during a past winter solstice. They match. I can hardly believe our timing. If I'd come at any other time, Hardy says, I would wonder how light could ever get in. It's well documented that prehistoric cultures around the world have marked the solstices at Stonehenge and other sites, but until relatively recently, archaeologists didn't know the ancient Pueblo peoples did so using carefully placed petroglyphs. These solar interactions have been intensively studied at Petrified Forest, and one of the easiest to see happens during the summer solstice at Puerco Pueblo. On one such solstice in the summer of 1977, artist Anna Sofayer watched a narrow band of light move through the center of a spiral petroglyph at New Mexico's Chacho Canyon, then published her observations in the journal Science. Among those who read the paper were Bob and Ann Preston, who later stopped at Petrified Forest National Park on their way to Albuquerque. Studying the petroglyphs at Newspaper Rock, Anne, a sculptor and painter, wondered if a spiral there exhibited something similar. That was a long road down, she says. In Albuquerque, we quickly bought a Brunton compass and clinometer and went back to Petrified Forest, says Bob, an astronomer at the Nassau Caltech Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and we got stuck there for years. The National Park Service provided the couple a home at the park for 3 or 4 years, with Anne spending a lot of time there and Bob joining her when he could. They set out to find every rock image with a spiral or circle to see if any of them demonstrated a similar interaction. Ultimately, they documented more than 3 dozen such interactions at 17 sites in or near the park, mostly on spirals or circles. Most of the petroglyph interactions they identified marked one or both solstices. Some observed the equinoxes, and a few marked multiple events. In one special cave alone, they documented 13 interactions. To this day, Anne says, I don't know of any other place like that. The Prestons took a hiatus from their work in the 1980s, but later returned to their fascination. There was a puzzle that related to astronomy and art, our two fields, Bob says, and it's tough to put down a puzzle until it's solved. Through 1996, they studied 46 prehistoric sites in Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah, and documented 109 interactions. They've since studied and documented many more such places. The purpose of solar calendars, and petroglyphs for that matter, is a matter of speculation, but the Prestons' analyses convinced them that the practice was widespread and intentional. Many of Petrified Forest calendar sites are closed or are not easily accessible to the public, but the one at Puerco Pueblo can be seen from a formal trail and viewing area. It's also among the largest of the roughly 1,400 archaeological sites in the park. With a nearly 360-degree view, the Pueblo was close enough to the Puerco River to support agriculture, while closer seeps and springs provided clean drinking water. As many as 200 people lived there at its peak. They were flourishing, Hardy says, based on evidence of specialization and an abundance of artifacts we'd call art, including pendants and beads. The ceramics are absolutely mind-blowing, he says, and that suggests villagers had the time and freedom to become artisans and engage in regional trade. That's going to go hand in hand with large-scale agriculture, Hardy says, and that endeavor may tie in to the solstice markers. In contemporary Pueblo cultures, the growing season is tied to a lifestyle, with fall ceremonies and hunting ceremonies interwoven and sometimes dictated by the time of year. So there were many reasons to track that, he says. On this winter day, the small spiral tucked between boulders at Puerco Pueblo is shaded and hard to see. But around 9 a.m., for 2 weeks surrounding the summer solstice, a shaft of light highlights it, penetrating the center. There is an interpretive display on the trail. For information, contact Petrified Forest National Park near Holbrook. Phone number 928-524-6228, website nps.gov/PEFO. The next article is entitled Pin Drop Travel Trailers. Insulated cabins and galley kitchens are among the many appealing features on these teardrop trailers, but the best thing might be the solar panels, which allow for an untethered experience. You won't have to plug in at a campground. articles written by Amima Ahmed. Like many business ideas, the inspiration for Pin Drop travel trailers came from necessity. Tim Ilinski and his family had been using a vintage camper for their trips, but was no longer a safe option. That was when Ilinski told his wife, Ruth Ellen, he was going to build his own teardrop trailer for the family's trip to Montana. I locked myself in my shop and came up with a solar-powered, self-contained micro-camper, Ilinski says. On the road, it turned a lot of heads and people wanted to purchase it, so my wife and I started thinking about starting a company. That company was founded in 2018 in Miami, Arizona, and still has its factory showroom there. But Pin Drop trailers now are in use across the country. Ilinski says he was surprised to find that much of the company's customer base is active retirees who are looking to downsize and explore. It's for people seeking that untethered experience because it's solar-powered, so you don't have to plug into a campground, he says. All Pin Drop trailers sleep two people in their insulated cabins, but configurations to add room for four people are available. Every model also includes a galley kitchen, a big draw for customers such as Ron Dunmeyer. He and his wife, Amy, first used a Pin Drop trailer nearly 4 years ago and loved that they can prepare the same quality meals on the road that they can at home. The Pin Drop design is well thought out and comfortable, and no space is wasted, Dunmeyer says. In addition to comfort amenities, the trailers can be configured to store 44 gallons of water, a necessity for long road trips, and they're insulated to allow year-round use. While they don't come with heating or air conditioning, each cabin has a ducted ventilation system and is insulated enough to retain heat in the winter and stay cool in the summer. We have been comfortable in all types of conditions, including rain and snow, Dunmeyer says. It's a true four-season camper. If you need a trailer for short-term use, Pin Drop trailers are available for rent, which Ilinski says is a good way to see how they work before making a purchase. And if there is a long-term fit, the trailers range from $28,000 to $38,000, depending on how many features are included. You'll also need a vehicle with a tow package and a 2,500-pound towing capacity to be able to tow a Pin Drop trailer. It's a big investment, but it's one Ilinski's customers have been willing to make, and they become intensely loyal to the Pin Drop brand in the process. Our customer base has done their homework, so when they land on us because of all the features and the functionality of all the things, Ilinski says. Out of all the trailers we've sold, only two people have sold theirs, so the rest are keeping them long-term. Along with his loyal customers, Ilinski credits his family for the growth and success. My daughters have really been there from the beginning. Their first memories are probably camping in the trailer, he says, and my wife is the grit that helps Pin Drop punch above its weight class. Dunmeyer and his wife are making family memories in their camper, too. He says they enjoy being able to go almost anywhere and be comfortable, and they love giving tours of the Pin Drop trailer and encouraging others who enjoy the outdoors to try out their own. This company walks its talk and is building something special that will benefit many people, he says. Pin Drop trailers can be viewed and purchased by appointment at the Miami showroom. Rentals are available, too, as well as through partner companies listed on the Pin Drop website. Pin Drop Travel Trailers is located at 168 North Miami Avenue in Miami. Phone number 928-300-8148. Website pindroptraveltrailers.com. The next article is Summers at the Beach by Kathy Montgomery. Tempe Beach Park, home of the state's first Olympic-sized swimming pool, opened in July 1923 as a place where kids could spend their summers. In the decades since, it featured a skating rink, tennis courts, an outdoor movie theater, Lovins, and draft protests. Today, the pool is gone, but the park is still the place to be on a hot summer night. As the sun rises over Tempe Town Lake, a golden poodle pulls a woman wearing spandex along the paved riverwalk past a flock of tethered swan boats. From the other direction, three college-age men on electric scooters scatter a flock of grackles as they glide past a middle-aged man in a neon shirt doing push-ups against a bench. It's a scene you might expect at a modern park in a college town, but the people who built the park a century ago would hardly recognize it. Over its long history, Tempe Beach Park has evolved to reflect the fashions and passions of the times. It has included a skating rink, a bowling alley, tennis courts, and in 1934, an outdoor movie theater. Boxing was big in the 40s, softball in the 50s, and love-ins and draft posts in the 60s. Through those decades, the one constant was the swimming pool. The state's first Olympic-sized pool was the reason the park was created, and it quickly became a regional attraction, hosting Arizona's first national competition in any sport. It also was where generations of kids learned to swim and spent long summer days. Those days loom large in the memories of those who came of age riding their bikes to Tempe Beach before stopping at the Laird family's Mill Avenue Pharmacy on the ride home for a 5-cent root beer in a frosted mug. It was a Charlie Brown world, an adult-free zone, writes Sally Cole in her collective memoir, Alligators in the Baby Pool, Remembering Tempe Beach. The sun beat down on the city's children, the water shimmered, and the jukebox played its endless tunes, punctuated by the rattle of the diving boards. Those of us who spent our youth there can call up those days from decades hence, can still smell the pool deck under our noses, can still feel the slap of a mist dive from the high board and that icy plunge. Before Tempe Beach, residents swam in the Salt River at a bend north of Tempe Butte, now also known as Hayden Butte or A Mountain, that the local newspaper described as a fine bathing pool with a stretch of sand surpassing many of the ocean beaches. There, locals installed a diving board and talked of building a bathhouse. But swimming in the river had its hazards, including broken bottles, tin cans, and risk of infectious diseases and drowning. The Tempe Civic Club, which later became the Chamber of Commerce, proposed a public pool as a safer alternative and a place where the city could host swimming and diving competitions. The club's preferred site was at First Street and Mill Avenue, where years earlier, Charles Hayden had cultivated a garden, planting grapevines, fruit trees, and stands of white oak and black walnut. The property's owner at the time agreed to sell it, offering a $500 rebate if the new facility bore the name Tempe Beach. The city purchased the land, and the Civic Club sold stock to build a pool. Tempe Beach opened in July 1923, but local kids didn't wait for the official opening to swim. William Windies jumped in the pool the first day it held water and continued to swim there nearly every day of every summer until he left Tempe at age 19. In an unpublished memoir, he wrote that he climbed onto the diving platform even before it had stairs so he could be the first to dive off it. A river rock building served as a ticket booth, and some boys spent nights on its roof, sleeping on old mattresses and jumping down to cool off in the pool. A couple of discarded structures served as bathhouses. Dr. Reginald Stroud recalled that it took real courage to enter them on a hot afternoon. Stroud bought the first sanctioned swim meet to Tempe Beach in 1925, and in 1932, Tempe beat bids from much larger cities to host the Women's National Swimming and Diving Championships, the first national sports competition held in Arizona. Kids lined up for free, Red Cross-sponsored swimming lessons taught assembly line style to 200 students at a time, and culminating with a goldfish swim. While teaching methods evolved, lessons remained a staple for decades. In 1927, Tempe bought land west of the pool, extending the park to Ash Avenue. The Civic Club's lease required yearly improvements, and that year, it built a river rock bandstand near the pool. It also continuously expanded the picnic area toward the river, planting grass and cottonwood trees. And after a committee member refused to vote on any issue until a new bathhouse was approved, the club commissioned one. Billed as the largest and best equipped in the Southwest when it opened in 1933, the River Rock structure at Mill and First kicked off an era of steady development with the help of the Works Progress Administration. Subsequent projects included croquet, horseshoes, and shuffleboard, along with a 3-lane bowling alley, a roller rink, a regulation tennis court, the finest court that can be produced, and a multi-purpose court. and newspaper stories in the 1930s mentioned baseball parks, handball courts, volleyball and softball courts, and a rock wall built of river boulders. Teams played football several nights a week, and in 1934, Dwight Red Harkins built an open-air movie theater, an ill-conceived project that lasted 3 months before a monsoon storm ended its run. Against the roadway leading to the Ash Avenue Bridge, the WPA built cobblestone bleachers, and it also surrounded the park with a cobblestone wall. The tennis courts stayed busy with lessons and tournaments. Boxing debuted in 1940, and by the 1950s, three-round Golden Gloves-sanctioned boxing cards took place in the old roller rink. But the biggest draw was softball. After lighting was installed in 1937, men's, women's, and youth leagues played nightly, and Tempe Beach hosted Western tournament games. Sometime in the 1950s, the multipurpose court was redesigned as a dedicated softball field. In later years, American Legion baseball teams played there, and Ladimir Ladmo Kwiatkowski of the Wallace and Ladmo Show fame coached Pee-wee, rookie, and all-star tennis. In the 1960s, young people packed the park for lovin's. There was a bunch of them, recalls Mary Holmes, whose family started coming to the pool in the early 50s when she was 3 or 4. It got to be almost every weekend, and there was always bands playing. Even after her family moved to Scottsdale, Holmes returned regularly. I used to go there at night with a group of guys and girls and would climb the trees and just sit in the trees and hang out because it was nice and cool. But by then, cracks were beginning to show in the summer paradise. As early as 1950, the Chamber of Commerce debated ending its sponsorship, citing the expense. Rough spots formed in the bottom of the pool and the surrounding deck cracked. Antiquated plumbing and electricity in the bathhouse created other issues. And because it lacked a filtration system, the pool had to be drained and refilled every few days. A former lifeguard recalled there being so much silt in the water by the end of the third day that lifeguards had to dive in with flashlights to search for swimmers before letting the water out. To address those issues, voters approved a bond issue to modernize the park in 1963, but many were dismayed by the results. A modern structure with a soaring roofline replaced the cobblestone bathhouse. The filtration system in the smaller pool required swim caps. Gone were the diving boards, grass, and cottonwoods. It didn't have the same feeling, says Terza Haywood, who quit the swim team. One patron told Cole that Tempe Beach wasn't fun anymore. For Cole, the real loss was the city's commons, where residents had always gathered for graduations and celebrations. Community members interviewed for a 1999 report recalled the park's lost natural beauty, lack of rules, and unparalleled freedom. The new pool that was expected to last 25 years, Cole noted, closed after 10. It sat empty for a decade until the Tempe Art Center adopted the facilities. The pool became an art installation called Terminal Beach and was later filled with sand and gravel for a sculpture garden. In 1998, the pool and its facilities were demolished as Tempe Beach prepared to remake itself again as part of the new Tempe Town Lake. By then, its primary users were unhoused residents. Today, a river rock entrance arch stands where the cobblestone bathhouse once did, and a wide promenade spans the former pool area. Most of the Ash Avenue Bridge was demolished in 1991, but a preserved abutment supports a veterans memorial. The cobblestone bleachers, protected behind chain-link fencing, await renovation. Tempe Beach Park now attracts new users who rent scooters and kayaks via mobile apps. Little League players use Luis Gonzalez Field, and the city hosts some 40 events at the park each year. In talking about the proposed reboot in 1999, then-Councilman Joe Sprinkle sounded both nostalgic and forward-looking. Tempe Beach was my salvation, he said of the 11 years he spent as a lifeguard and swim coach. Everybody was there. It was a social gathering place all summer long. We're going to bring it back. We really are. And this concludes Summers at the Beach. I'll conclude today's readings with a little Arizona humor. A young doctor, fresh from the Midwest, had just opened his practice near a reservation. As he walked through town one day, an Indian approached him, asking how much he would charge to go to the reservation. The doctor, seeing he was obviously of little means, said, Oh, I'll drive out there for $5. Okay, said the Indian, let's go. The pair drove toward the village in silence as the Indian pointed the way to a small home on the edge of the reservation. As they came to a stop, the doctor grabbed his bag from the back seat and asked, who is it that's sick? Oh, no one's sick, replied the Indian. A taxi cost $7.50, submitted by W.N. Craig of Tucson. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
I love you, Arizona. Your mountains, deserts, and streams rise of Dos Cabezas and the outlaws I see in my dreams. I love you, Arizona.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Log on to sunsounds.org, left click on broadcast info and audio, then under programming links, left click on demand podcasts. In addition, you can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.